This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is author Elizabeth Grossman. Elizabeth is the author of High-Tech Trash, Digital Devices, Hidden Toxics, and the Human Health, Watershed, The Undamming of America, and Adventuring Along the Lewis and Clark Trail. Her writing has appeared in Mother Jones, The Nation, Salon, The Washington Post, and other publications. Elizabeth Grossman is here today to tell us about her most recent book, Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry, published in 2009 by Island Press. Welcome.
Thank you.
What led you to write your book, Chasing Molecules?
Well, it was my last book, High-Tech Trash, which you just mentioned, which inspired me to embark on this project. And while I was working on that book, which explored the environmental impacts of the entire life cycle of high-tech electronics, I became far more interested than I probably needed to be by what scientists were discovering about the synthetic chemicals used in electronics, things like brominated flame retardants, chemicals called perfluorinated compounds, a lot of the chemicals used to make plastics. I was absolutely fascinated by the fact that scientists were finding these chemicals far away from where these products were ever used or manufactured or even disposed of, and I wanted to know why that was happening and if we could improve on those products.
The title of your book has the phrase, the promise of green chemistry. What is green chemistry and how is it different from standard chemistry?
Well, there are green chemists who say if we actually do all of this right and achieve the goals of green chemistry, we won't have to call it green chemistry anymore. It will just be chemistry. That said, one of the most fundamental ideas behind green chemistry is the idea that the best way of preventing chemical pollution and, by extension, any health hazards that would come with it is to prevent that pollution at the very, very beginning of making a new material by removing the hazard at the design stage so that if you don't have toxic chemicals in your product, you never have to worry about where that product goes or how it's used. So the whole idea is to make new materials that are inherently and essentially environmentally benign.
Would you review for us what is known about the safety of the chemicals that are in commercial production in the U.S.?
That is an enormous question. There are now over 80,000 chemicals registered for commerce in the United States, chemicals that are used industrially, widely in commercial products. Right now, under the system we now have for regulating these kind of chemicals, only 200 of those chemicals have been, according to the EPA, fully tested. There's lots of other testing that goes on by scientists all over the world, but right now we really only know about 200 chemicals in terms of their toxicity.
What is known about the effects on human health of those chemicals that have been looked at?
Obviously, there are lots of different effects on human health from these chemicals, but one category of chemicals that has been coming under increasing scrutiny are a whole set of chemicals essentially derived from petroleum-based petrochemicals. And there are industrial chemicals that have been studied for many, many years, some of which are known to have really serious adverse health impacts that can cause cancers, can cause birth defects. Some of these chemicals have been taken off the market either through regulation or voluntarily. But there's a whole new category of synthetic chemicals. They're not new to use, but their effects have only recently been discovered in the past couple of decades. And these are chemicals that can, even at very, very low levels of exposure, prompt changes to how genetics work and also can interfere with how hormones work. And between the two of these effects, adversely impact a whole host of really important bodily systems, metabolism, reproduction, neurological health, to name just a few.
And what would be some examples of these chemicals?
Well, a couple of chemicals that have been much in the news lately for these kind of effects, several of them, I can think of right off the bat, brominated flame retardants that are used widely in plastics, also in textiles and upholstery. There are lots of different chemicals that are brominated flame retardants, but one set of them goes by the acronym PBDEs. Their full name is polybrominated biphenyl ethers, a real mouthful, but PBDEs have kind of been in the news lately because they have turned out to be endocrine disruptors, and they do seem to have an effect on thyroid hormone function and on neurological function. And because of this, a number of them are starting to be restricted. Other chemicals under similar type of scrutiny for these kind of endocrine-disrupting health effects is a chemical known as bisphenol A, which is the chemical building block of polycarbonate plastics, so virtually ubiquitous in our lives today. And another set of these chemicals are ones with yet another mouthful of a name, phthalates, which are plasticizers, and there's a whole suite of these chemicals, and they are used to make PVC, polyvinyl chloride plastic, flexible. But it turns out that they can migrate out of the finished product and finished plastics, and they also have been identified as endocrine disruptors.
What are the major sources of toxic chemicals in the environment?
Initially, the biggest source of toxic chemicals in the environment has been industry, coming directly out of smokestacks and waste pipes of various sorts, and also out of waste disposal sites. And that's quite understandably where our initial focus has been over the past, say, 30 or 40 years of really taking a hard look at getting these kind of chemicals out of the environment. But one of the things that, again, has changed in the past few decades, or even shorter period of time, past 10 years or so, is the recognition that a lot of chemicals don't actually stay put, that they actually can migrate or leach out of finished products, consumer products, everyday products, as we're using them, as the products were intended. It's not in disposal. It's not when they're ripped up or smashed, but as something is sitting in your home as it's intended to be used. And little bits of these chemicals can get out into adjacent air, into household dust, into water, into soil, into food, and into us.
In your book, you speak about toxic chemicals being widespread in the environment worldwide. What is known about the degree of contamination worldwide, all over the globe?
Well, one of the things that I learned, and that was actually one of the things that got me really intrigued to look at this whole area of research, was the fact that some of these chemicals have structures and chemical compositions that make them resist environmental degradation. So they last for a really long time in the environment, not just days or weeks, but even years and sometimes decades. So once they get out into outdoor air, into the global air currents and ocean currents, they can move with air and oceans and with precipitation and storm systems and move continents away from where they started out. So those kind of long-lasting, persistent, environmentally mobile chemicals are now being found literally everywhere on Earth that scientists have looked.
Would you comment more about some of the pristine places that they've turned up?
Well, pristine is now not as pristine as it used to be. One of the places these chemicals are turning up in really disconcertingly high quantities is in the Arctic. And I was actually lucky enough to go along on a couple of international polar year expeditions in the past year or so with scientists who are studying and tracking these chemicals in their northward drift to the Arctic. And one of the things I learned is that anything released in the northern hemisphere eventually moves with atmospheric and global circulation north. And when it gets to the far north, typically these chemicals get lodged in ice, in snow, in permafrost. And historically, they've kind of stayed there. But one of the things that scientists are realizing is that now that some of this ice and permafrost is melting a lot faster and to a greater extent than it was, these chemicals are now being released in a way that they hadn't been before.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Elizabeth Grossman, author of the book Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How effective is the regulation of toxic chemicals?
Well, briefly, I would say not very effective. And one of the things that's actually been in the news, if you read that segment of the news lately, is indeed how ineffective our current system of regulating chemicals really is. Not everybody would completely agree with that, but again, under the major law that we have to control and regulate chemicals that are used industrially and in commerce, it's a very long, cumbersome process to actually regulate these chemicals at the federal level. Lots of individual states are now trying to enact policy that will restrict certain hazardous chemicals, particularly from products that are intended for children. And this is gaining some ground all over the country. The Pacific Northwest has been particularly active in that. Washington State, where we are now, has really taken a lead on this, as has California and Oregon to some extent, other states around the country. But they're going at this on a chemical-by-chemical basis. And this, I think, is fairly ineffective and cumbersome for a number of reasons. And that is because the process is so long. There's so many products out there. There's so many different chemicals. And we're also exposed to so many different chemicals at once that just taking one out of the equation may not actually achieve everything that you want it to in that way. So our process for doing this is very cumbersome. It's often a long, contentious, and fraught process that doesn't really result in really protecting people as effectively as it could.
You point out in your book a number of examples in which a compound is found to be toxic and then replaced with a substitute that also turns out to be problematic. Would you explain and give examples?
Yes, and I think that also gets to part of the answers for your previous question as to how what we're doing now is perhaps not as effective as it could be. What we have done typically is when we identify a chemical as having some serious health or environmental impact problems, either the chemical, a regulation is passed, as it was, say, with PCBs that were used as industrial insulating fluids but turned out to be carcinogenic and also very environmentally persistent. These get taken off the market. They either by regulation or there's just so much evidence out there that manufacturers know that nobody's going to want to buy their product if this has this chemical in it. So those things get taken off the market. But the way we do this now, as I mentioned, is on a chemical by chemical basis. So if we go to another example, the brominated flame retardants, we've now identified this suite of flame retardants known as PBDEs as problematic in terms of health impacts. Well, we can pass laws, as Washington State have, to get these specific three or four chemicals out of the products. But we still have fire resistant standards and things still need to be made flame resistant. So a substitute product is created. And under the system we have now, there is nothing that would direct a manufacturer of either a chemical or a product to say, ooh, let's look at an entire class of chemicals. Let's look at how these actual molecules behave. Instead, we're just looking at the name. So say we have banned Octa BDE. Well, we can drop something else in that place, and we might find out that, well, the new flame retardant is based on the same chemistry as the old flame retardant. It just doesn't have a name that's turning up on a banned list. So that's actually what's been happening. And what I'm hoping will happen, and I think that's maybe part of some chemical policy reform, is to expand how we look at chemicals so that we don't keep repeating this cycle of simply tweaking a molecule or slightly altering a product, and just because it doesn't have the same name, using something that has similar health effects.
For someone who buys products and would like to avoid some of the toxics, you point out in your book that it can be difficult to determine what chemicals are actually in a given product. As an example, would you like to speak about your efforts to find out something about the newer, supposedly less toxic coatings to nonstick pans for cooking.
This was actually, I think, one of my favorite chapters in the book to write about the frying pans. One of the chemicals I mentioned early on that had caught my attention were these perfluorinated compounds, these molecules that are loaded up with fluorine. And in electronics, they're used for microchip etching. And they're very, very stable molecules, and they make really good flexible surfaces that can do all sorts of useful things in addition to microchip etching, like make non-stick surfaces. In some formulations, they're what we might generically refer to as Teflon or non-stick coatings used in cookware. But the same chemicals are also used to make stain repellent products, things, again, generically we might call Scotchgard type products. And they also make grease-resistant coatings that are actually used in food wrapping. But these things turn out to be very, very stable. They resist environmental degradation. They've turned out to have some really disconcerting health effects in terms of suppressing immune systems and also being endocrine disruptors. So there's a great interest in coming up with something that does the same thing but is not this problem chemical. So I was seeing all these signs actually where I live in Portland in some high-end kitchen shops for eco-friendly, environmentally friendly non-stick pans. And I thought, wow, let me try to find out what this stuff is. And I sometimes feel like I'm a dog with a sock that I won't let go of when I try to find this stuff. But it was really, really hard. It led me to all sorts of dead ends or to bits of information that were so confusing and so opaque that in the end I realized I couldn't really find out what was in these chemicals. Some of the new non-stick surfaces are actually reformulations of the same chemical Teflon, essentially, that we have been using, just a slightly different shape molecule, slightly smaller molecule. Some I have no idea what they really are. The only way I could find out was to look at lists of ingredients, and there was one company that had so many ingredients in its formulation that you just have to throw up your hands and say, I have no idea what this thing is.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Elizabeth Grossman, author of the book Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry. In the design of new chemicals, what are the questions a green chemist would ask that aren't usually asked by a conventional chemist? What are the criteria of a green chemist?
Well, that again gets to the absolute basis of green chemistry. And I think I might back up and say, even in advance of explaining what the questions are that green chemists are asking as they're designing new materials, is to tell you one of the other really astonishing things I learned while working on this book. And that is that to this day, if you're getting a degree in chemistry, a PhD in chemistry, or you're embarking on a career as a professional synthetic industrial chemist, there is nothing in your academic training that requires you to take a course in toxicology or any other environmental health science that would train you to look for or understand what makes a molecule or a chemical toxic. So the fact that historically and traditionally commercial chemistry has not asked questions about how a molecule behaves, how a substance behaves environmentally, asking questions about whether it's going to be water soluble or not. And if it's not water soluble, is it soluble in fat? Is it going to end up finding its way to fat cells and fat tissue and therefore entering the food chain? Is it going to be something that will evaporate easily and perhaps get out into surrounding air? Is it going to be the kind of molecule that could interfere with endocrine hormones? No one has been asking these questions at the beginning design phase of a chemical. Typically, new chemical products were simply created, marveled at, perhaps rushed into some really useful commercial application, and then you'd look at the toxicity and look at its environmental impacts. And that kind of testing has been done, but not at the very beginning of the design stage when you could still change things in a way that would prevent those problem chemicals from entering the environment and coming into contact with people.
Would you elaborate on how the application of green chemistry will help solve the problems that we were speaking about earlier?
Well, I think really, really simply, the whole idea is that if you don't build hazards in to new materials, if you design materials without hazards and that are inherently environmentally benign, you don't have to try and deal with that problem at the end of the pipe, at the end of the smokestack or the drain pipe, or try to keep things in products where they seem to be emerging from. And as one of the founders of green chemistry, Paul Anastas, who heads the green chemistry program at Yale University, has said, now we deal with chemical security with guns, guards, and gates. And he thinks that this is ultimately ineffective because if there's a problem, the risk, as he says, goes to the maximum. So much, much better. And what green chemistry advocates is taking care of those chemical security issues by designing things that are inherently safe. So that's how it really would change the landscape. We wouldn't have to worry about hazardous chemical spills, hazardous chemical products, if what we're using is safe to begin with.
To what extent is the approach of green chemistry being adopted?
Well, it's moving slowly. I think a lot of people, including myself now, wish it was moving a lot faster. There are lots and lots of products already out on the market that are adopting or do work with principles of green chemistry, and there's some really nice examples out there. And all of the major chemical manufacturers are supporting green chemistry efforts to some extent. But at the same time, there's a huge investment in the historical older stream of chemicals. So, of course, there is resistance to letting those products go. So the analogy I came up with for my book towards the end when I was thinking about how things seem to be at a kind of point of tension was the character from Dr. Dolittle, that animal called the push-me-pull-you that had heads at both ends of its body and wanted to walk in two directions at once. And I think with green chemistry, we're a little bit at that stage. John Warner, who's one of the other founders of green chemistry, says we're kind of at more of a tipping point, but sometimes I'm not so sure. But that said, green chemistry products are gaining ground. There is a lot of benefit to business for adopting green chemistry simply to save money. Hazardous chemicals are expensive to deal with. They have lots of costs associated with storing and handling them and protecting workers from them and disposing of them. So if you use less of them, saves you money. If you become more resource efficient, which is something else green chemistry advocates, using less chemicals overall, less materials, less energy, you will also save money. So there are lots of attractions and it's gaining ground in that way, but it's not quite, I think, where it needs to be to become the predominant way we're going.
What are some of the green chemistry products that are out being sold at the present time?
Well, one of the ones that has one of the nicest stories, and it's actually been told again and again, but it is such a good story that I think I'll use it here. And that's a product that was developed for Columbia Forest Products, which makes plywood products and particle board things. And traditionally, the glues, essentially, the epoxies that hold plywood together have been based on volatile organic chemistry products and compounds like formaldehyde that are quite hazardous. And what Columbia Forest Products has done is work with a scientist who actually is in Oregon, and he was out at the Oregon coast and just happened to be looking at mussels as they were clinging to a rock. And all of a sudden it occurred to him that they were clinging on very, very successfully and very tenaciously, and clearly they were doing this without formaldehyde-based epoxies. So he took a sample of this bonding material that the shells were using back to his lab, analyzed it, and managed to create a synthetic material based on that chemistry, which is now being used in the place of toxic formaldehyde by Columbia Forest Products very successfully. And another little interesting wrinkle in this story is that part of the reason this product has been so successful for Columbia Forest Products is because California, at about the same time this product was being developed, was ramping up its indoor air quality regulations and saying, you know, we've got to really bring down the levels of these hazardous compounds like formaldehyde in indoor air. So we're not going to allow those kind of wood products in these situations. And so this opened up a big market opportunity. So it's a really interesting case about how trying to improve health through regulation of a product has helped spur development of a new environmentally safe product.
What is most needed to help promote green chemistry?
I think it perhaps comes from two directions. What I came away from my research for this book thinking is that we needed lots more education to really incorporate green chemistry into science curriculum everywhere at every level. We also need a huge amount of investment in research and development to spur the creation of new products, because it's just not going to happen unless we say we want this to happen and actually put some resources there. And at the same time, I think it does have to be accompanied by some regulation, either to create new high standards to protect the environment and human health from chemical hazards or from the hazards of specific chemicals, or perhaps some combination of the two. Because I don't think you're going to get enough traction if we haven't opened up a gap where you need new products. But green chemistry, it shouldn't be looked at as a piece of regulation. I think it should be more inspiring, but I think we're going to need both sort of carrots and sticks from various directions to open up the opportunities so that it can really begin to flourish.
What are some political initiatives that support green chemistry?
There are a number of them, and we're probably going to be seeing a lot more of them. California, Michigan, Maine have all enacted some kind of policy that supports green chemistry in different ways, either in terms of research and development, seeing it as a jobs opportunity for local industry in the case of Michigan. Some states or local communities have been enacting various kinds of what are called environmentally preferable purchasing programs, where they're encouraging both governments and other institutions to choose products that are environmentally safe and therefore kind of spur the adoption of safer green chemistry products. So there's a whole range of things that are happening. And again, it's a little bit tricky because green chemistry is a set of principles. It's not a set of standards or a certification program like organics are. So it's still a little bit out there as to what exactly is a green chemistry product. How do we make sure these products are truly green? But there's lots of effort to push towards safer products at various levels and from various perspectives, and often simply by encouraging people to choose things that are safer.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That I think truly one of the best ways to prevent chemical pollution is by doing what green chemistry advocates, is to get the hazard out at the design stage and create new products that are without chemical hazards, and to control the pollution and the health problems really early on rather than trying to capture them. That said, I think we also need to make as much effort as we can to get some of the really problematic chemicals out of the equation and to make safe products more affordable, more easily available, so that they become the norm rather than the exception.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We have just been speaking with Elizabeth Grossman, author of the book Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry, published in 2009 by Island Press. For more information, check on the web at www.chasingmolecules.org. Again, that's chasingmolecules.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.